Now, whom pods destroy.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry, and I'm joined, as always, by Derek.
Hello.
And by Graham.
Hello.
Well, listeners, we are moving stately towards our 40th anniversary celebration of Star Trek The Motion Picture, which is in November. We're recording this in October. And as we have done with the previous episodes, we're taking a slight detour away from Star Trek to discuss a film, a science fiction film made in 1968 or released in 1968, that we feel has had a profound effect on the genre in general and to an extent on Star Trek The Motion Picture. There are certainly themes to which we can draw on. That movie is, of course, 2001, A Space Odyssey, directed and produced by Stanley Kubrick. Interestingly, Stanley Kubrick won, I think, the Oscar for special effects for this movie, even though he didn't do the special effects. The special effects team was so vast that they could only put a certain number of names on the nomination.
But he did have, he had a finger.
Well, he had a hand in everything.
But it was his vision, wasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose. But I mean, you might perhaps argue that Doug Trumbull might have earned it a little bit more. Interesting.
Definitely.
Anyway, that to an extent is Kubrick, because as you say, he is a man who micromanaged every movie that he made. Certainly his mark is all over this movie. This is a movie that is quite profound, so I think there's some wisdom in perhaps trying to get an idea of our first impressions of this film when we first saw it. Derek, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I remember watching this at school. I'm saying primary school. This was the thing, which was, it was a bit inappropriate for primary school, I think, and I was about 10. And it was like the summer holidays, teacher decided to bring in a cine reel projector version of 2001. And we all sat up in the hall and tried to watch this. As I remember, I was actually quite into it, but I didn't understand a thing about it. And as you can probably imagine, a load of sort of kids a range between 7 and 11. It was a bit of a nightmare. So I didn't actually, you know, people sort of like laying on the ground who couldn't take, teachers glowering at the kids.
I don't know why they would be doing that. I mean, I'm all for educating kids and like trying to introduce this kind of culture by osmosis, but you just got to acknowledge that these are children and this is 2001 and bluntly, they're going to be bored. Yeah. There might be moments of it that they'll capture and will really hit them, but to expect them to sit through over 2 hours of that,
I think they're probably more likely to start hitting each other over the head with bones.
That's what actually happens. Yeah, it was definitely the Dawn of Man.
So in many ways, it was like touching the monolith.
It was a really good thing. Then.
It was an interactive experience, you know, before this became a thing.
When you finished, did you go off and go back to the classroom and start designing weapons platforms?
Oh, I think they let us loose on the world actually, because it was probably you know how long that film is. I mean,
it does explain quite a lot, though, Derek.
Probably does, yeah. My sort of grunting every once in a while.
Graham, your experience of 2001 is probably more by osmosis, isn't it, really? I don't know whether you have any particular recollection you were saying of when the first time you saw this movie.
No, not really. I probably saw it late 80s, early 90s when I was a bit more formed. Probably at a time when I was aware of what it was like and what its reputation was, of how you approach it and how you understood it. I was probably old enough as well not to be expecting Star Wars, and so being able to give it the time that it needs, because it does need time. I would say it's an impenetrable film. It certainly isn't. It's certainly easy to understand as far as the narrative goes for the first 80% of it anyway. In fact, it's slow enough that you really shouldn't get confused about the first three quarters, 80% of it anyway.
No, I mean, my experience is exactly the same as yours, I think. Mm. I watched it on the television. I watched it with my parents on the television. I don't know when it was, but I was old. I mean, I was fully formed. And I can tell you, I can tell you when it was to an extent, because it was after Aliens. And the reason why I knew it was after Aliens had come out is because there's a piece of music that is used during 2001 when we're introduced to the Discovery. And there's a phrase that is used in that piece of music that is exactly the same as that is which is used by James Horner in Aliens. And I thought, James Horner must have ripped that off. So it was after Aliens. And I would have been a bloke. Yeah. Mm. I mean, late teens, but a bloke, you know, yeah. Working, you know. So, I mean, I have to acknowledge that the movie did leave me cold somewhat. I'm a child of Star Wars, and I just thought, there's something profound about this movie, but I'm not certain that I can be asked to think about it anymore. And so it's only really later in life that I've gone on with it. They started making this movie in 1965, 66, something like that.
I think that's right, yeah. Actually, yeah.
And it wasn't released until 1968. In terms of its production values, I don't know whether on how recently you guys have seen it or what format you've seen it in, but it is, for me, still an absolutely immaculate production.
Oh, certainly.
I don't think that there's a great deal. I think there's lots of things that you could look at and say you can improve that technically with modern filmmaking techniques, but I'm not entirely certain whether or not you would want to. I don't know whether that's something that you would agree with.
I totally agree. I mean, the thing is that I actually watched it again last night.
Did you?
The thing is that the construction of the whole thing, I mean, because it's the four different parts to, you know, four different, what they call scenes or...
It had originally been intended as a portmanteau rather than a single story.
Yeah. So it's four different acts through it. But the design, and especially when you get to the third act, where you've got the actual Discovery on its route to Jupiter, some of those lovely scenes with the technology, you know, because you obviously the whole sort of design about it, the clean lines and everything like this, and the way the camera is, there's all those like, scenes where it's dead centre and everything's symmetrical, and it's beautiful, and the colours. I mean, I'm really lucky that I actually watched it on a really good, because now you can actually get really good prints rather than when we were probably watching it on TV first time round or maybe on VHS. And now you can get some really sparkling versions of it, like on all different formats we get now at home. It's brilliant.
What do you think, Graham? The symmetry in the movie is something that's very, very striking. It's something that comes up quite a lot throughout that movie. And it's got to be a deliberate thing by Kubrick.
Oh, certainly. Not only the symmetry you see on the screen, but the symmetry in the narrative and certain scenes that appear again, but in a completely different setting or circumstance. It is beautiful. It was when it was originally released, it was only available in 70mm, so they knew how beautiful it was.
And Cinerama, of course, because it was released in which is an old dead format now. But...
curved screen. So shot for the sake of looking beautiful, some would say. But obviously it is trying to be it's an immersive experience rather than just a narrative experience. And that's what I think some people think aren't ready for with it. What it does do is it redefines the way you present a science fiction film. Mm. You use the space as something that is something to behold, and also the inner spaces on board ships as well, which sets the tone for every onboard science fiction-based production since then. the use of the red light in the deactivation of Hal scene and the reflections of his helmet. They're beautiful, but they're used. They're ubiquitous now, aren't they?
Yeah.
Up to Star Trek Discovery. There's so much from the final scenes of the second series that just harkened back to 2001. And this is, what, 50 years?
50 years,
literally. And it's still
50 years later.
Fresh as a daisy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's over 50 years, because when they first started on it, it was, as you said, like 1965. And, I mean, Kubrick had come straight up. You know, he had come. His last one before then was Doctor Strangelove, you know, which is a
masterpiece.
Masterpiece as well. And the thing about this film is it is a proper collaborative, and it is micromanaged. But I was watching an interview with R.C. Clarke, because he wrote it, you know, in collaboration with Kubrick, and did the novelization at the same time as them actually writing the screenplay. So there are slight differences there. But they actually, it was a complete collaboration there. And they took that, the original short story, The Sentinel. As the jumping off point.
Clark's narrative in the book is a lot. Clark's, I mean, he's obviously a genius science fiction writer and was a visionary. His prose style is quite, to my mind, quite utilitarian. 2001, the movie, is open for the viewer to decide what this film is about. 2001, the book, very much is about the progression of mankind and the evolution of the species to the next level. And subsequent sequels to 2001, written by Clark and then adapted 2010, take their cue from that. So if you wanted to have a canon discussion about 2001, then you could almost actually say that the Kubrick version actually sits outside that, which is kind of ironic because, yeah, the two were produced in, you know, together in parallel to a certain degree.
But there was two different formats of the art, because with cinema, I mean, Kubrick made a decision that when he first started, he was having narration over the top of it to explain all of this stuff. But as he was going through it, because he's a visual person, he basically, because this movie has less than 50% dialogue.
That's 40 minutes of dialogue in the whole thing.
Yeah. Which is, you know, amazing, because the rest of it is just you watching, absorbing, listening with your eyes, and, you know, basically, and making up the story there. It's the same story. It's just that there's a lot of interpretation from you and what the clues that Kubrick has given you to make up your mind of where you're going.
Kubrick was quite well known for not being explicit about what his movies were about. And 2001, I think, is the best example of that. This is the movie. You decide what this movie is about. I'm not going to help you do that. Which I think is very much the definition of any great art.
Mm.
And it's made to a level, a technical level, that really, for me, it qualifies as one of the great artworks of all time. It's just a movie, as opposed to, say, a painting or an installation.
Yeah, it's nearer a painting, actually. I was just going to say, because you said art, it is actually nearer a painting. Yeah. When you go along to one of the art galleries and you look at a painting, and you see that sort of that, you know, especially one of the old masters, they've actually put lots of detail and bits and pieces and storylines all the way through it. But it's up to you to make the decision of what happens, and it's the same with the film.
Yeah, it's the same with a piece of music as well. People aren't going to say, I love Dvorak's New World Symphony, but I really don't get the ending. I don't know what's that about. You don't do it. You just absorb it, and you appreciate it. You love it for what it is.
Yeah.
And that's, I think,
we are used to watching movies from the Hollywood studios. Yeah. And they guide us through these movies. These movies have plot, and they have character, they have development, and that's what we are. So then we're confronted with someone who throws all those rules, most of those rules out, and presents something different for you, a different narrative. You're understandably uncertain as to what to think and how to proceed. And those emotions are perfectly valid.
Yeah.
Incidentally, they're perfectly valid. Let's just dwell quickly a bit more on production, because I do want to just highlight the fact this movie was made in Boreham Wood, not far from where we are, the other side of London to where we are in Elstree Studios.
Yes.
And
where they make Big Brother.
Where they made Big Brother.
Because
that show was cancelled. The crew is mostly British, and there are some interesting stories. At one point during production, they were filming during the 1966 World Cup, and a number of crew who weren't working at the time were watching that on the television, and they had to break production for a moment because they were the crew was shaking the set when Jeff Hurst scored the fourth.
I didn't know that.
In there, so that's quite a nice story. And another thing that you might be interested in, one of the guys who worked on the effects there was a chap called Brian Johnson, Derek.
Yes.
I wonder if you know what Brian Johnson went on to do.
Let me think.
Oh, God, no. Oh, dear. It wasn't something moon-based, was it?
I wouldn't know.
Yes, you would.
I mean, there is actually a lot of crossovers there anyway.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it's hardly surprising, isn't it?
I mean, where it was positioned. I mean, the thing is that it's quite interesting. There's a little story with Ed Bishop, who's also in it, who obviously is a big mainstay for the Gerry Anderson stuff. And he played in UFO.
Of course.
You know, which I think they used some of the stuff from 2001 that's probably left over.
Ah. No, they didn't.
They didn't, no.
Kubrick had almost all of it trashed.
Did he?
Because he didn't want a studio making shitty films with his props.
Man,
and they would have done. Yes, they would have done. They would have made shitty films with his props. Yeah. And so in one respect, you can understand why he did it. But in other respects, it's an utter tragedy because they were, you know, glorious works. But, I mean, in fairness, they would have had to have been preserved and looked after, and that would have cost money. And at the time, it wouldn't have been clear why you would want to do something like
that. I did actually see a picture of they rescued the
The orbital,
yes, because it was
and
left
it's
out.
Looking very sorry for itself, was, yes. Yeah, in a quarry somewhere. Yeah, I've seen that picture too. Yeah. It's very sad. It's very sad. Okay, and also football. For our Sound of Football, another football link, the costume designer, Hardy Amies, who also designed the kits and suits for the 1966 England squad.
Oh, wow.
Interesting guy. If you ever do any work or background work on Hardy Amies as a human being, very interesting human being, he had a shop in Savile Row and a designer label. And
did he do the suit? Yeah, he did all the lovely suits. Oh, I would love one of those.
Did he do the training tops?
I would assume
the sky blue tracksuits because they are a style.
I mean, they are gorgeous.
Yeah.
And I mean, Hardy Amies was absolutely bang on trend at that point.
Yeah.
So the taste that's being exercised in this film as well.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like nothing but the best. But in many ways, I think as British people, as Englishmen, take a degree of pride in the fact that the aesthetic of this movie is very much born of this country. Even though it's guided by an American, we should take a degree of glory.
I mean, the production design of it, though, I think you see that this film takes on board the fact that throughout the 60s, production design became really, really important. And we see it in the Bond films, the Ken Adams stuff, which really does set the tone for lots of films to follow. I mean, Ken Adams, well, he redefined it, didn't he, really? About how you set up a franchise or even just a standalone
Absolutely.
Movie.
Yeah. Interesting that we will be talking about Ken Adams in our next podcast. Okay, let's move on to the segments of the movie a little bit. We don't want to do a breakdown of the movie. I mean, if you've not seen this movie, it doesn't matter because we're not spoiling it for you because literally nobody knows what this movie is actually about. So
no, they do. I mean, the themes come back. I mean,
yeah, but you know, if you've lived on this planet of any length of time, you've encountered this movie one way or another. Maybe not seen it, but you've, you know, I mean, like most of my experience of 2001 was in the late 1990s when I just used to watch the Stargate sequence smoking weed. But so you know, I mean, you know, I'm sure maybe there are listeners who have similar experiences. You know, The Dawn of Man sequence, a beautifully, beautifully photographed sequence, but I guess it's Dan Richter who plays the character Moonwatcher, the sort of head man-ape in this movie. I mean, he is probably the Andy Serkis, Andy Serkis of his time, isn't he?
Mm.
And an astonishing performance given the problems that they had, and as you can imagine. So what do we think about that and say something like, putting it up against Planet of the Apes, it's a different situation. But you know, in terms of how convincing those costumes and the performances were,
I was going to say the performances, but also the set, because you see, the set is not in the Serengeti at all.
No, it's in Borehamwood.
It's in Borehamwood, yes. And you're one who loves painted scenery, backgrounds, and stuff like this. And obviously, that whole thing there,
yeah,
is actually painted. Even though it actually does look realistic, it's amazing what they did. I mean, I'm sure I've read some stuff about the actual film techniques that they tried to, you know, to incorporate and to make it actually look realistic, and how they reused bits of it with different lighting.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. But going back to your thing about the actual realistic portray of, like, you know, man apes as such, I think it's just engrossing. It's brilliant. I mean, the whole thing is just something that you can absorb, because there's no proper dialogue at all. And the shots with, like, the bits when the dust comes down, you see the animal's eyes light up and stuff. Mm. It's sublime. Mm. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, we know that they're men in monkey suits,
and you do have some chimpanzees, baby chimpanzees there.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, in fairness, yeah.
But you know, I don't think that takes anything out. I mean, we've said before that you know, you've got to let yourself inhabit the world that you that is being presented for you. Yes, you can say, oh no, that's not happening. But you can say that about every
sincerity is the key with all of these things. If the filmmakers are being sincere, then you can buy into it.
And the actors completely buy into it. And these are performance artists who are operating here, and they carried off really well.
And it was over 5 decades ago. And anything else that was on TV, I mean, on those little screens and black and white, probably, and like and any other cinema experience was nowhere near as good as that.
Yeah, no way.
Really,
no way. You know. I think probably. I mean, there's pivotal moments in the movie, and after Moonwatcher discovers that bones aren't just for gnawing at. Well, not even for gnawing at, because they've gone from being vegetarians and then they become meat eaters because Moonwatcher discovers how to kill tapirs, and we go from there. But what I enjoyed about also was the soundscape of the film, is that as soon as they've started eating meat, you hear this constant buzzing of insects where none was present beforehand. Mm-hmm. So you've gone from this kind of extinction level sort of like moment with these man apes, and then suddenly they've got plenty, and along come the insects. To me, it demonstrates just how something like this can have an immediate impact on your environment, which I think is stuff to think about, and that's the thing that strikes me about that scene. And of course, I think probably what's most noteworthy is the monolith, with the first time that we see the monolith
and the sound design, the music.
Perhaps let's just have a quick word about the music. There was a score originally composed for this by a gentleman called Alex North, who was a veteran composer, very highly regarded. It wasn't completed, but the stuff that was done so far, Kubrick went, yeah, all right, thanks very much, Alex, I don't want any more. That's fine. And he ditched the whole lot. And he used, and a lot of the classical music that you hear in that was originally used as placement music, as a cue for the composer to say, this is what I'm after. And he just went with that. Elzo Sprach there at Zarathustra, for example, wasn't originally intended to be in there, and yet it is synonymous with the movie now. And in fact, for many people, they listen to that piece of music and they all say it's the theme tune to 2001.
Yeah.
They won't say it's Elzo Sprach Zarathustra. Alex North didn't realise this was happening until he was in the theatre watching it, which is a bit naughty.
Very naughty, considering the relationship between Kubrick, because he'd done his previous films. He did the scores for Paths of Glory.
Did he do Spartacus as well? I wonder if he did Spartacus.
I'm not too
sure. So there was the end of that relationship. Jerry Goldsmith did a great deal of work, and he was a friend of Alex North. He did a great deal of work in getting that soundtrack together and getting it published, at least. And it is out there, so you can listen to it. It reminds me of Planet of the Apes a lot.
Right.
And, I mean, I can't imagine it over 2001. I just can't. But then there's reasons for that. Had it happened, who knows? Anyway, I suspect Kubrick made the right call. It's just, I suppose, the way in which he went about it is not so good. But it is quite interesting, because some of the music that is used in there is like, for example, the Blue Danube Waltz. That is considered, I think, by many as being one of the finest pieces of music ever composed. It sounds to me a very European-centric, Western-centric position to take.
Yes.
But nevertheless. And I suppose it's being introduced in this movie to communicate to us that we're now at a point where, you know, humanity is at its zenith, because we've got this wonderful sequence, and
Kubrick used this before in Paths of Glory, and the reason why he used it, it's like he used it in a scene in Paths of Glory where there's a waltz going on in a next door room when Kirk Douglas comes along. And he's furious about what he's had to do, turning on his own troops and all this sort of stuff. And you have the rest of the sort of establishment who are having a waltz next door. There's a massive door and he pushes it open and the music comes out. And it's the same sort of thing I find with this, because this is the door from Dawn of Man to the next act.
Yeah, we're not ignoring the match cut, but you were going to say something.
I think for what it's there for and what it was there for there is that it's meant to be evocative of the Enlightenment.
Of
a period of time where we think we know everything.
Yeah.
And you can see that the it's used again, not in for the music, but in style, with the furniture in Dave's room at the end.
Yes,
that's all from that same period, and they're all meant to be like this sort of period where we are at the zenith.
Yeah, well, you've touched on it. The whole thing is actually about births.
Yes,
because you've got the Dawn of Man, the birth of man. The next scene you've got is there's a birthday in every single sequence. Is what's happening is you've got the birthday with Floyd with his daughter,
yeah,
and then also you've got the birthday with Frank.
Happy birthday, Frank!
Mm-hmm. And then you've got the birth of the star child.
Yeah,
all the way through, and as you said, it's a Renaissance. The whole thing is forward motion, evolution.
Mm. So therefore that Strauss piece of music is vital, I think, to that, and any other piece of music would have not been, we wouldn't have got as much richness from that, I think.
The Blue Danube is also an important piece of music because it's on a three time, and so it's not a march. So most cinematic music is done in a march, it's on a four beat. So it's so when you have something like a waltz, it's on a different beat. So it actually makes a different sound.
Because that both of those sequences feel like a more like a montage, don't they? They're certainly we might recognise them now more like music videos. The match cut from Dawn of Man sequence to this sequence is one of the most famous, isn't it?
Mm.
The bone being lodged up in the air, and then as it comes down, it cuts to the weapons platform. So we've gone from the first weapon to conceivably the last. Although we're not aware of this necessarily at the time. And it's extremely, every time I watch it, it's great. But I will pay tribute to that meme that's going around that I've seen on the internet, where someone replaces the weapons platform with Luke Skywalker's lightsaber coming down and falling into his hand in The Return of the Jedi.
I haven't seen that.
which is really funny. I'm all on board for that.
I was actually thinking about The Simpsons.
Yes.
That too.
With the Fox satellite.
But they're all mean exactly the same thing. And, let's just talk quickly. The actors in this sequence, William Sylvester, for those of you who are listening from the United States, you might not know guys like William Sylvester and Ed Bishop, because these were American actors who lived in the United Kingdom, and they hoovered up all the English roles, all the American roles.
They were Yanks for hire, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And the other guy, whose name I can't remember, but Robert Beatty is another one. He would turn up in BBC and ITV productions
and
of the era.
And as Derek says, Gerry Anderson stuff all the time, isn't it?
Yeah, because he said, we need an American, so we're fine, we'll just hire William Sylvester. Yeah. William Sylvester was in a great, awful monster movie called Gorgo, which is a British movie.
That's a
which
classic.
Is both, it's terrible and it's
Harry
brilliant.
Harrison?
And it is, I think it is Harry Harrison, isn't it? But it's just a ghastly movie.
I mean, it's so ghastly they actually did a Chew-Its advert as a homage. You remember that?
So rubbish. And Ed Bishop, of course, as you say, Derek, was in UFO, the 1960s, Gerry Anderson.
Captain Scarlet
as his voiceover. And his voice was heard, if you listen to Radio 4 back in the 70s and 80s, I remember listening to a great serialisation of The Big Sleep, where Ed Bishop played Philip Marlowe. He was brilliant. He's only in this movie for a short while, sadly. But I always look at it and I think, oh, man, Ed Bishop, I love that guy.
There is stuff like Whoops Apocalypse as well.
Yes,
was in that. And was he in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as well, I think?
Bound to have been, but in fairness, I don't know.
Yeah.
And he's still ticking along, isn't he?
I should bloody well hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, they're still
money
to be
working. Yeah.
He's turned up in a couple of James Bond films as a usually a guy in a Spectre control room or he was in NASA. He was a NASA member of staff in You Only Live Twice. Hawaii to Jupiter 16. I think that's him. Hawaii to Jupiter 16.
Klaus Hergesheimer.
If Gary Andrews is listening to this, he's going, you're forgetting Klaus Hergesheimer. Klaus Hergesheimer in Diamonds Are Forever. So, yeah, Ed Bishop, we love him. Sorry, he's not really in this movie that much. This movie's not about Ed Bishop.
This is the official Ed Bishop podcast.
We're just all right. Anyway, thing. Back to sorry, profound. Profound 2001. What a wonderful masterpiece. Ed Bishop.
Klaus Hergesheimer. If you go about Leonard Rossiter.
And Leonard Rossiter, yes, Dr. Yeah. Shmislov. Mm-hmm. Who was in Barry Lyndon as well?
Yes,
was he not?
It was. Yes, yeah.
And I'm sure you know. You guys know Leonard Rossiter, wonderful comic actor of your now no longer with us, sadly, but an absolute genius actor. Rising Dampen, Reggie Perrin. So this section then moves on to the moon, and they've got this. We've got quite a lot of plot after a fashion going on here, and it leads to the second introduction of the monolith, and then. The big piercing
which
screen.
Is basically the spine of the story, because that's where the Sentinel story comes into it. Because it was originally the short story was they find something on the moon and it sends a signal, because it's basically the burglar alarm, and this is what this part is. But obviously the whole story is built around the forward evolution of humanity.
And then the third sequence is the discovery sequence, and let's dwell on this sequence. You've got Keir Delay, who is playing Dave Bowman, and then you've got Gary Lockwood, Star Trek's Gary Lockwood, Gary Mitchell from When Airmen Has Gone Before, playing
the second pilot,
and then you've got Douglas Rain, who's playing the voice of HAL 9000. And I mean, I think is probably where the Star Trek relationship might come into with the motion picture, but this is the story of how HAL is either malfunctions or goes rogue, or takes it upon himself to take control of the Discovery mission to go and find the monolith for himself. Or what do you think's going on? What do you think's going on here?
Do you know something? I don't know.
No, we don't know. No. What we know is that he's gone wrong. There is the message there that we get from the organisers of the trip to say that, you know, if you're hearing this message, you've had to shut down the computer.
Yeah.
So there is some reason that someone thought that the computer will have to be turned off at some point.
Yeah.
But let's face it, I mean, like, HAL went online in, 1992? He was probably operating on Windows 3.1.1.
if they haven't got all their, patches up to date.
Yeah, exactly. If he'd been out there 9 years.
I mean, it must take a long time to download a patch over that length of time.
That's a lovely sequence, though, with the bit where you have the contact with Earth, which obviously is time-delayed, where they're actually explaining that sort of like they've got another version of HAL on Earth where they've done exactly the same computations, and they've got a completely different result. And this is an exact, duplicate. And obviously the crew, Bowman and Frank, decide to sort of like ask HAL, what do you make of this? And he comes out, it's human error, which I think is beautiful. it's a great sort of like there's a passive aggressive confrontation that's starting up and building, distrust that starts to build into the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, this is for me. This is what the film is. It's two films and it's two stories in one. You've got the story of alien life contacting humans, but you've also got the other sci-fi trope of artificial intelligence going rogue, and that's what we have. And it is again about reaching another stage of evolution, and this is our own creation reaching another stage of evolution.
Yeah.
And for want of a better word, surpassing us. And so we either, that's the exploration here, we either choose to be subservient to our own creation, or we get
destroy
rid of it
and
evolve ourselves into a higher being.
Which, I mean, if you buy that theory of the movie, and that's perfectly, then that's where the movie ends up.
Yeah.
I mean, there are the theories, there's a good, strong theory that HAL doesn't break. HAL decides that he wants to get to the monolith and make the evolutionary step.
You know, because the thing is,
I suppose it is. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He's
but it's
got
not.
His own
it's a deliberate motives. Malfunction. He makes that step. There are also those who say that the chess match that HAL plays with Frank say that Frank hadn't lost that chess match. and he just took Hal's word for it, and that would be, and the assumption would be, and nobody ever asked Kubrick whether or not this was a deliberate thing, whether he did that, or whether or not that was Kubrick just saying, yeah, fine. But because Kubrick micromanages, it plays nicely into that thought that he said, well, what we'll do is we'll, Hal is testing Frank to see whether or not he's thinking straight, whether or not he can maybe pull the wool over his eyes. And the conversation with Dave about how he was concerned about the mission, and you know how the other crew members were brought in already in stasis, and you know, and again was sort of like, you know, pushing things, and then he brings his plan into motion, cuts off that transmitter, and then, you know, the horror ensues, and it is horror, isn't it? This movie moves into a bit. It is horror. The design of that pod, that shuttle pod, is amazing because it's one, in one sense, it's beautiful. And then in another context, it's horrific.
It's a cage.
With its cold arms and its and the way that it, you know, is used to murder Frank is genuinely horrific. That sequence is quite long. Even by modern standards today, I think that studios would look at that and say, you really do have to cut this down. Do you think that that's right to do that, or do you think that it's perfect as it is, or is somewhere in between?
I think it's perfectly match, because the thing is that it's creating a evocative scene of it starts off, it's very mundane, it's quiet, there's not much, there's not much actual, there's a background buzz of sort of like things going on, but it's like these people are living in this environment, and the day-to-day thing isn't a case of that, you know, that they're jumping around like on a starship. Yeah. Checking everything. They're actually going somewhere on a long odyssey. You know, they've got a specific mission to do. And you're actually getting the whole feel of how things change. And then when it changes very slightly, bit by bit by bit. And it ramps up the tension as it goes along. Because you know that these are three characters who are on this, in this one scene, and how they're interplay. And obviously one of them has a different mission underneath it, and is actually going to affect the others, and how does it play out? You know, as you know, the tension does ratchet up, and I think that long sequence is great. I'm at the right age now to really absorb it, I suppose. When I was a 10-year-old kid, I couldn't.
In all of the scenes when they're on the way to Jupiter, there is, like what we've seen with the moon program, the everyone who watched that would have been so steeped in everything but what was going on the Apollo missions, and how procedural they were, and about how the conversations that they always have were things that were happening and things that were going to happen and things that were that needed to change because something had gone wrong or something like that. And it's very machine-like, isn't it? So we're already accepting Hal there and the way that he interacts with them. He's, in many ways, he's even more human than the humans themselves, because the humans that are just acting like machines, certain.
Well, Frank's message from his parents, Frank is like not really acting like somebody who is pleased to see his parents. He's, the humanity has been stripped from these guys, presumably because of just the isolation.
Yeah.
And the fact that they are they're working together, they barely need to speak to each other,
well,
really. They
have,
there's nothing left to say.
You know,
yeah, because they're obviously up to it, but it's an examination on what happens to human beings under when you change their environment, when the context of their lives completely change, and which undermines your point, Graham, that Hal is is being the most human out of all of them.
Yeah,
but he loses because Dave Bowman has experience and ingenuity and is able to beat Hal, and he murders him, I think, executes him.
Well, it's a bit interesting. That's how we look at it.
That's how I look at it.
Yeah, it's how it's interpreted online. The death of Hal, rather than the deactivation of Hal because of what it is. But it's such a powerful scene.
Yeah,
almost 5 minutes it takes to kill him.
Yeah, and it's to listen to. It's very, very unpleasant. It's very uncomfortable to listen to. Especially when he says, "I feel it," you know, "I feel it."
I'm afraid,
and I'm afraid. And you're listening to this, and you're instantly you're transferring your sympathy over to Hal. Hal has earned the right to have this kind of compassion from the audience through the fact that he's clearly a human being, but he's also, to a degree, earned the right to be executed in that environment. Mm-hmm. because there's no jail for HAL 9000 computers and nothing else to do. Yeah. There is no choice. It tells us about just how taking a life is painful for everyone concerned and everyone, and nobody really wins from it. And it's for me, it's one of the great scenes. Matched, Graham, by its visuals, I think.
Helping with the
blood red interior. Mm. I mean,
And the product and the design, the set design as well.
Amazing.
The way that those memory blocks just slide out.
Yeah.
They're beautifully designed anyway, but the movement of them is just stunning, and it all played with the soundtrack of Dave's breathing.
Mm. Yeah, which is Stanley Kubrick's breathing, I think.
It's
actually cool. All of those breathing sequences are actually Kubrick's. Yeah.
But it is soundtrack because it sets a beat. It sets as better than anything. Breathing and a heartbeat will always set a beat to a film, and will always get you into that.
Yeah.
Into that feeling, because you'll many times you will find that your heartbeat will try and match that, or your breathing will match that as well. So it can actually change you physiologically as well.
So the Stargate sequence then, and the end game, the end sequence.
Yeah.
I mean, and the evolution, if you like, and the birth of the Star Child, and all of that. So what are we to make of this sequence? First of all, on a technical level, there was some serious groundbreaking stuff going on there. But then also at the other time, there was also just a guy who went out on a helicopter and was taking video shots of the Scottish Highlands and of Mount Rushmore, I think, in the US as well. There was some stuff that came over as well. So for me, there's parts of that that are just still to this day visually stunning and relevant and hold up anywhere. And then there are other parts of it where you think, that's not so much. What do you have a view on that?
It's pop art, man, in many respects. In certain respects, it's just Warhol in some images that they've got there. It is meant to be looked at and viewed to hit certain parts of your brain.
Yeah.
Well, it reminds me of when we had the Voyager satellites going out, and the idea that they were putting the plates on, that with all of the information, sort of like that's what I sort of saw it, because it's the humanity, all the bits and pieces.
And I suppose it also reminds you of Voyager as well.
Of course. You know.
We've arrived at the hotel scene. Is it a hotel room? I always call it a hotel room.
The cage.
It's a cage. It is a cage, yes. Because you can see the...
Yeah.
Yes, now I can see that now, actually. It is a cage. But it's a gilded cage.
Yes.
And are we to assume that Dave is kept there by these unseen aliens and prepared for his emergence as a new life form? Would that be reasonable? What's this film about, guys?
Well, I still think it's about rebirth.
Rebirth
and emergence and
a new evolution. So
yes.
We're going from one evolutionary step
yeah.
to another, and then we've got the emotional cues of people's birthdays and whatnot to help us.
Well, we don't know if this is natural evolution, because we don't know if all of our evolutions or our evolutionary steps have been natural, because obviously we go back to the monolith.
We have to infer that the presence of the monolith triggering an evolutionary step, that it isn't natural, that it weren't for the intervention of the monolith.
And this one's the fourth monolith we come across?
Mm.
Yes. So they're actually quite compressed, I suppose, when we're actually going through this progression. We don't know how many other monoliths there have been in between.
No, those
maybe
are the ones we're told
more,
about.
Yeah.
There may well have been other ones.
Yeah.
Because remember at the time, there was a start of the Eric von Daniken, the Chariots of the Gods, was very big in popular culture. About sort of astronauts coming down to Earth and basically helping us evolve.
The ancient aliens thing.
Yes. Yeah. And this is what I took from this as well.
I'm not a big fan of that theory, I've got to say.
Oh, no. I, it's one of those ones, in fact, which is quite funny. It used to be very prominent in Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World.
Yeah.
Do you remember that programme with the crystal skull?
Yeah, I do, and I remember. I remember every week Arthur C. Clarke would come on and say, well, I think not.
I think this is horseshit.
And
I think we got there on arrow.
But that sort of stuff has just been forgotten about now. I mean, it's like UFOs was a big thing.
We're not. I don't think people are really comfortable in looking back on our forebears particularly from other parts of the world, and saying, oh, those guys could never have achieved this because we don't know how to do it now.
Yeah.
The fact that we are not certain how the Egyptians constructed the pyramids doesn't mean that they didn't know that. It's more likely that this is forgotten knowledge than it is aliens coming down and helping them. It really is. And the fact that there are people who genuinely believe that. Now, we know people who love that kind of stuff because it's fun narrative.
Yes.
There's not, no, they don't believe it. They just think it's fun. But for those who do believe it, then reflect on yourself, I would say.
But the whole thing, the whole story is also a creation of a modern myth, right? It's the Odyssey.
Yes.
You know,
it's, well, you even have the Cyclops there, don't you?
Yeah, you've got the Cyclops. Yeah. You've got, basically, the monolith is the god, one of the gods, you know, or loads of gods. And they're the ones who've steered humanity in a certain way. You know, it is a story. It's not to be taken seriously, but it is a modern myth for us to enjoy. And
the end of it, of course, yes, it is. You can look at it in a literal sense and find it completely baffling, but it's meant to be baffling. It's meant to be only understandable by someone on a higher plane, a plane that we are 1,000, 10,000 years away from. And of course, when we get to that higher plane, we'll look back on this film and think, well, that still doesn't make sense, because no one knew how to make it to be understood by someone from 10,000 years in the future.
You know, I mean, also, it's a story. I mean, the idea about the new birth of I mean, choosing into a baby, a star child, is very interesting, because obviously it's a rebirth of humanity into something else. But it's also, at this time, we've got the Cold War, we're still in, you know, going on. People thinking that probably humanity are going to destroy themselves anyway.
The existence of the weapon, the first thing we see when we go into 2001, the year 2001 is the weapons platform. And we're told immediately that, you know, we're at probably, again, like at another extinction level event.
Yeah.
As the man-apes were when they were picking berries out of the earth, trying to find some food. You know, we're now at this point where we're ready to crack open the planet like it was an egg. And the story goes on from
and
there.
And popular culture was going through about sort of like the hippie movement and other sort of movements of people trying to find other ways away from the sort of the main sort of warring structure of humanity.
And the hippie culture, and the movie resonated very strongly with hippie culture. And not just because it's got that trippy sequence that's fun to watch when you're smoking weed. That's superficial. Yeah. In that respect, the comparisons with motion picture are probably quite superficial as well.
I don't know. I actually think there's quite a lot. I mean, I think then motion picture, the whole thing about evolution into new life forms is the same. It's the same story. It's just in different ways.
Is that how you see it, Graham?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's there is obviously it's based on The Changeling, of course, which preceded this, but it covers the general stories of evolution and rebirth that 2001 covers there, really. But Vija has come back as a higher form of life,
but needs to take the next step.
Yeah.
Needs to become a needs to reunite, so to speak, with its
or find its creator or find meaning in itself.
Yeah.
Remember, Vija is in certain cases a baby as well in the film. And the thing is that we've got, even with Hal, when Hal goes, who's dying, he turns into his infant form. But you've also got, you know, there are the sort of analogues between those, I find. And also, I mean, a very dangerous baby. Both of them are very dangerous babies. But the idea about sort of like when Decker and Ilya sort of like transform into a new life form. You know, again, the Star Child is a new life form. There's hope somewhere after all this rubbish that we go through. You know, humanity does.
Motion picture's not that bad, mate.
That's not that bad. That's a great film. But, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we like science fiction predominantly, is that we look at things forward, hopeful things. We love Star Trek because it shows us there is a hopeful progression or path for humanity, but that is full of adventure. You know, and
well, that's very interesting, because most of the science fiction that followed this film through the 70s is pretty much entirely dystopian up until Star Wars and Close Encounters,
and we will be discussing those films in our next podcast, which means that you may well have arrived at our segue and indeed our egress from this discussion, Graham. Possibly deliberately, Because I know you're a skilled podcaster.
I can't let you do that, Terry.
So, our next podcast will indeed be an exploration of 70s science fiction, but we'll be moving it back into war towards Star Trek, and that is we will be discussing the 70s science fiction landscape, and we'll also be talking about the development of Star Trek during the 1970s, its various iterations before we arrived at the motion picture. I just want to quickly name check a podcast that I relied on heavily for my research, and that is Open the Podcast Doors Howl, which is a by-the-minute podcast by Rudy and Chris, and it's finished now, so the whole back catalogue is there for you to listen to, and a lot of the facts that I have said here have come from that podcast, so I would like to just quickly name-check them and thank them. So, until next time, from me, Terry, and from Derek and from Graham, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.